It appears we're ready to proceed. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors.
This is a WebEx calendar for the Court of Appeals today, July 8, 2020. The panel composition is myself, Renee Werke, presiding, and Judge Tracy Smith. Each of you, of course, has 15 minutes for your argument. 5 minutes will be reserved to appellant counsel for rebuttal if you choose to use that. When you're not speaking, please mute your microphone so we don't have background noise. And with that said, I will call the next case, file A19-1730, in re the paternity of BLT. Appellant counsel, when you're ready to proceed, go ahead.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel. We're here today to address the district court's failure to
Could you indicate apply. Your name and which party you're sure. speaking for?
Yes, Lori McWagner, representing the appellant Taylor McCall.
Thank you.
Yes, we have a few major issues. The first one is the district court had found that domestic abuse occurred, but then did not address or apply the presumption against joint legal custody. The district court's facts, in fact, that she found overwhelmingly against father in this case, and then led to the conclusion that it was that joint legal custody was appropriate. There are plenty of legal errors about that, and I'm going to launch into that issue first. Under Minnesota statute section 518.17, subdivision 1, B9, the court is directed to use the rebuttable presumption that joint legal custody or joint physical custody is not in the best interest of the child if a domestic abuse has occurred between the parties. And the court must consider the nature and context of the domestic abuse and the implications of the domestic abuse for parenting and the child's safety, well-being, and development. I think it's really important to remember what the court said about the domestic abuse finding. The court said, the minor child has been witness to conflict between the parties. Father continues to send repeated and harassing text messages to mother and expresses a significant level of animosity toward her. This inhibits his-
Ms. McWagner, yes. Let's say for the sake of argument, we agree with you that the court did not apply the presumption. Would it be your position that this case should be reversed and remanded so that the court could either apply the presumption and decide why it's overcome or just reversed based on the fact the other way and the factors that when it went through seemed to favor your client? Which do you think is the most on that issue? What would you like us to do?
I would like the court just to reverse and award sole legal custody because I believe that the factors are so overwhelming and show a continued harassment from the court's own findings. I just think that the conclusion of joint legal custody and joint physical custody, there just isn't any evidence to overcome all those strong facts that the court already found.
So counsel, can I interrupt you? I just wanted to, and maybe you clarified it. At first he said just so it should be sole legal custody, but then second you said legal and
physical. Well,
I just want to make sure I understand what you're saying about that.
Well, sole legal and sole physical, I think the bigger concern is the sole legal. I think that when the court has already found that he has the inability to make decisions in the best interest of the minor child, the court is already finding that the domestic abuse is impacting the child. The court also said the child witnessed it, and also in other findings talks about how father has a lack of awareness of the undue stress that he puts on the child by exposing her to conflict. I just don't see how you can have all of those factors and the continuing nature of this toxic relationship and say, even implicitly, have the presumption overcome. And then when we look at the record evidence, the record is replete with numerous examples of how the parties were unable to decide anything. And, I understand that the other side's position is that the court didn't need to address it because the court can, quote, implicitly find it. But I think you need to look at the factors that the court already found and how those would with any implicit findings that the court may have made. We just think that the facts are so overwhelming as found by the court that this court could avoid the remand and just find that there wasn't enough evidence to even overcome it. So there wouldn't be a way to explain it. The other concern that we have is that the way the court, the finding about why joint legal custody was ordered says neither of these parents is incapable of working jointly to raise their child, though some behavior has indicated an unwillingness to try. Decisions going forward must be focused, forcing both parents to set their animosity for each other aside. First, I think that the statute directs the court to consider both the willingness and ability of parents to cooperate. And here the court is saying that there is an unwillingness there. So I think that you need to have both a willingness and ability. And the court in this finding is already acknowledging there's an unwillingness. The second part is that this finding of why the court ordered joint legal custody in joint physical contradicts the other finding in the domestic abuse section that says that father has, that his animosity has affected his ability to make joint decisions in the best interest of the child. Third, the other problem with what the court did here is the Chapman case talked about using joint legal custody as a legal baseball bat to force parents to cooperate. And we believe that that is what the court is doing here with a complete history of, you know, serious conflict even throughout the proceedings and multiple decisions. And just the court even talks about father's unwillingness to follow court orders and how he looks for legal loopholes and how he's, you know, rigid and values winning for the sake of winning. This is not good for this child to have these parents having an equal power and equal say. It's going to lead to discord for the child and inability to move forward. Again, there's no history of being able to make decisions. As a matter of fact, father even admitted that in trial. He said, and when we asked him if you have a disagreement with mother and how it's typically resolved, he said it's not. So I don't know what the court was trying to accomplish here. And quite frankly, when I read all the facts and I got to that particular sentence, I was surprised. The other challenges that we have towards the court's order has to do with, you know, we have 12 factors. Two of them don't apply. Seven of them went in mom's favor, none of them went in dad's favor, and two were neutral. When we looked at the neutral factors, one of them was the willingness and ability of each parent to provide ongoing care for the child, to meet the child's ongoing developmental, emotional, spiritual, and cultural needs. The court provided that mother provides consistent care and a stable schedule, and that father exercises solo care. So it seems to be like a double standard. And when you look at, does father really provide or meet the child's emotional needs? If you look at all the other factors, it conflicts with four other factors that the court had findings. Court had numerous findings on, you know, father's, you know, exposes her to conflict. He uses marijuana while caring for her. He fails to use a life jacket. Failed to properly secure her in a car seat. Failed to store his firearm safely. Using an unsecured baby bike seat. He had a lack of understanding as to why his conduct might be creating undue stress for his child. So it's difficult to understand how that's a neutral factor and that the court is finding that his willingness to exercise parenting time and have solo care would be neutral when you have all those other findings. And especially the court also called on that he would call on mother for at-home care during his parenting time. So we disagree that that makes sense in light of the other factors. The other challenge that we had was the effect of the proposed arrangement on the ongoing relationships between the child and each parent, siblings, and other significant persons in the child's life. It says it's neutral. And then the court gives like all these negative factors about dad and doesn't really explain them away. And then says some criticisms of mom, but then says that they seem reasonable or more directed at other factors. The way the court handled it was, I guess, inconsistent. For example, when the court said mom had concerns about the child going out of state, she said, oh, but that really had more to do with mom being concerned that he has two kids and only one driver to drive through the night. So on one hand, criticizing mom, but then saying mom's concerns were reasonable, not doing the same for dad, criticizing dad, not offsetting him, but then saying the factor is neutral. So
if I heard you right, Ms. MacWagner, I thought I heard you say that we didn't need to remand, that you simply wanted us to reverse. But don't we need to have the district court issue corresponding findings in order for that to happen?
Well,
we certainly aren't going to make findings of fact.
Okay, so if the court is, I think there would probably need to be a correction on the one finding, because I do believe this is a legally incorrect finding that doesn't flow from all the other findings, which is neither of these parents is incapable of working jointly to raise their child, though some behavior has indicated an unwillingness to try. I think that if the court were to remand, there would have to be some specific direction on what needs to be done.
Let me then turn your attention to parenting time, because that's, you're running out of time, and that is also an issue that you raised. Do you have any main objections to the parent? I mean, if you had to pick one objection that you felt was primary about the implemented parenting time schedule, what would that be? I mean, it appears to me you've got somebody dropping off at childcare, picking up at childcare, and it looks like it's laid out pretty straightforward.
It has to do with the fact that the court, for whatever reason, did not make all the exchanges at the daycare and has for my client's weekend to start at noon on Saturday. That would automatically force an in-person interaction and would never give her a full weekend of time. The other part is, after finding that he harasses her, that he's so rigid in his thinking, the court tells my client essentially to go negotiate with her abuser if she wants more time. And so,
she's not required to have an in-person meeting with him. I mean, she can correspond with him text or email or written communication, can't she?
Right, but she's depending on his good graces to actually trade with her. And she's dependent on, that's a power aspect that he has over her. If she wants a free weekend, she's got to negotiate with him, whether it's over the phone, whether it's through our, she's depending on him to actually be reasonable and grant her some weekend time. And he's shown no indication, as the thousands of text messages, hundreds that we provided, to be reasonable. And so that's the biggest concern.
Judge Lanny did include in her parenting time order that when you talked about that they'd be forced to meet not every exchange would be made at childcare, there is a provision in there, and correct me if I'm wrong, that they can have a third party, they can appoint a third party, a designee, if you will, to go ahead and do the, effectuate that. Like, I'll send my sister, I'll send my mom. Doesn't that resolve the problem?
I think it resolves it somewhat, but then again, you're dependent on getting help from other people to do that. Our proposed schedules had the daycare as a natural exchange place where you wouldn't have that that problem.
I can't help but think of the old adage, it takes a village to raise a child, and sometimes it's good to have other parties involved. That has nothing to do with your position one way or the other, but just a remark that I don't know if that's a bad thing.
Council, apropos of that, was the problem, though, I think in the briefing it was suggested that the what the court was trying to address was the 12 hours needed at childcare instead of 10, given the schedule of the parties. Can you speak to that? That's why it went into us to try and minimize the child, given their schedules, the child's going, I'm Sam over time a little bit, the child's time at childcare.
Your time has expired, but go ahead and answer Judge Smith's question.
Yes, I do think that that was initially a concern, and then we did present evidence that and our proposed order that she would be able to manage getting the child on time for the start of her weekend. And again, I think she would ask other people at that time to help her.
Thank you. We'll turn to respondent counsel.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Michelle Keel, and I represent the respondent father in this matter. I plan to organize my remarks into three issues. First, the trial court did not abuse its discretion when it implicitly found that the presumption against joint custody had been rebutted. Second, the trial court did not abuse its discretion in the weighing of the best interest factors and concluding that joint custody was in the child's best interest based on that weighing. And third, the exact parenting schedule ordered by the trial court was not an abuse of discretion. First, I'll address this presumption against joint custody. And it is true that when there's a domestic abuse finding, that there's a presumption that joint custody is not in the best interest of the child. However, this presumption only dictates the result when there is an entire lack of evidence to the contrary. And this court in the Beeberg versus Beeberg case held that the presumption can be implicitly rebutted. And that's what the court found here. By finding that joint custody is in the best interest of the child, the court stated that the parties are capable of working together. And although some evidence indicated an unwillingness to try, that statement necessarily means that some evidence did indicate a willingness to try. And the trial court was in the best position to judge the credibility of all of the parties and make that determination that they were able to work together in a joint custody arrangement.
This counsel could, in talking about the Beeberg case, aside from the fact that it's unpublished, I mean, there the district court did not explicitly find that the respondent had abused appellant and found that domestic abuse was not an issue in this case. I mean, that's different from our case, isn't it?
Well, in that case, the party had admitted that it was, and so the Court of Appeals stated that the presumption should apply, even though the trial court sort of glossed over it. So actually, I think that case was even a more egregious circumstance than this case, because there was an admission of domestic abuse, and other circumstances suggested that the abuse in that situation was more serious than the facts that we have here. Notably, the trial court rejected most of the allegations that mother had in her proposed findings regarding the domestic abuse. It mentioned only one incident rather than the three that she had alleged. That one incident happened over a year before trial. The trial court recognized that father claimed self-defense, and the child was a very young age. All of these are factors that courts have considered in the past to be reasons why joint custody may be appropriate, even though there is a domestic abuse finding.
You're not arguing, are you, that the district court did not find domestic abuse? I mean, the district court found it, did it not?
Correct. We are not arguing that there's no finding of domestic abuse. We're arguing that the finding of domestic abuse occurred, the presumption was applied, and the presumption was implicitly rebutted. And then to the point raised
by- And that, just to be clear, the domestic abuse was by father, the husband. And it was in connection with the gun incident, right?
The trial court mentions the gun incident in the findings. It's not super clear about, it doesn't expressly say father committed domestic abuse, but I recognize that the gun incident was mentioned in the findings in that same paragraph, so.
In the same paragraph as the only incident of domestic. I mean, there was no other incident by mom, for example, or the other ones that you're saying were rejected.
There was no other incident mentioned in the findings of fact. There was evidence presented at trial that both parties were violent.
Right, I'm talking about the court's findings. Okay, right. Thanks.
Right. And then to address a question asked by a couple of judges previously, that the correct procedure would be to remand to the district court. And that's particularly important with this presumption issue because the Minnesota Supreme Court was clear in Thornton versus Vasquez that the presumption is against a custody arrangement. It's not against a particular custodian. So we would need to have a remand because either the district court needs to more clearly explain, our argument is that it did clearly explain that it was implicitly rebutted. But if it did not, if this court finds it did not, it could either remand for additional findings to further explain why the presumption was rebutted, but it also needs to decide if the presumption is not rebutted, which parent gets sole custody, because it's not, this court cannot assume that the trial court would have granted sole custody to mother.
Let me make sure I follow this, Ms. Cole. In your briefing, you're relying on Biberg and you're indicating that the court doesn't need to make detailed findings. I'm hearing you today say, yes, in fact, there should be some detailed findings, not just the implicit reading of what the court did. Do you agree then that it should be returned for those findings to be made?
I apologize, I tripped over my words a bit. What I meant to say was, our argument is that the findings are sufficient, that the court implicitly found that the presumption was rebutted. However, if the court disagrees with that argument, then it would need to be remanded and the court can either make additional findings regarding why it's rebutted or decide which parent gets sole custody. I am disagreeing with opposing counsel in that no remand is necessary. And then if there are no more questions.
If on that point, counsel, and I appreciate it, I do understand what you're saying. But in order to do that, i.e. make additional findings as to why the, I can't imagine based on this record that the court is going to give, you know, your client sole legal physical custody. So if it was going to be remanded for additional findings, would the court have to be then changing all of its factors that it found in favor of appellant in order to overcome if we find that the presumption was not implicitly made, but not made at all? Would the court have to then change all of its findings? Because it seems to me none of them really favored you, your client, I mean. So is the court, in order to overcome that presumption, going to have to at least make more findings in favor of your client and take away the findings? It would have to change the findings on the factors, would it not?
Well, the findings on the factors, admittedly, the majority of them were found in favor of mother, but they were not found against father, and they were not found in favor of mother having sole custody. So the trial court, I think could explain a little bit better how the presumption is overcome, potentially if you wanted to issue a remand. But it's not an abuse of discretion to find joint custody. And I don't think this court can simply assume that sole custody would have been awarded in favor of mother without giving the trial court an opportunity to explain its credibility findings more explicitly.
So I had a question about that. So the findings, I think I recall, they either favored mother, right? They were none favoring father.
That's correct.
So let's just assume for a moment that a district court concluded that all findings favored mother. Could a district court still conclude, whichever it is, that it was in a joint or the best interest of the child that the custody be joint? Are you saying that's within the court's discretion to do irrespective of the absence of any findings in favor of parent?
I think that is within the court's discretion. This court has previously rejected attempts to look at the best or the factors as a scoreboard and tally them up and say their majority are in favor of one party, so that party gets custody. This court has rejected that approach in the past, and that's what mother's attempting to do here.
I'm sure you and Ms. Mack Wagner know the cases better than I do, but it seems to me in the cases that we did that, it was, you know, some favored one, some favored the other, and then, you know, the court at the end of the day kind of has to make a judgment call and explain why and et cetera. I am unaware, sort of as what Judge Smith is getting at, I'm unaware of any case where, you know, all the factors favor one parent, the rest are neutral and or don't favor the other, and the court then, you know, either applying the presumption or not, you know, gave custody to the other person, and we've affirmed that. I mean, I would just think that would be a classic abuse of discretion. I mean, because, well, so am I wrong on that, counsel?
I don't know any particular case where all of the factors weighed and the court gave joint custody, not off the top of my head, certainly, but I think it is within the court's discretion. You know, of course, abuse of discretion is a high standard for the appellant to meet. And, you know, the court does have some findings that are, you know, favorable to father. It says the parties are capable of working together. You know, it says a variety of different things sort of sprinkled throughout the order. And I think that the court can consider those and reach a conclusion of joint custody without it being an abuse of discretion. I would like to turn to the parenting time schedule briefly with the remainder of my time. The parenting time schedule ordered was not an abuse of discretion because the trial court was really faced with a difficult situation of trying to, you know, harmonize the parties' different work schedules. And it reached a conclusion, a schedule that allows father to only have to go into work late once every 2 week period, rather than under mother's proposed schedule, he would have been late to work three times in every 2 week period. And there was evidence before the trial court that although he's trying to be flexible in his job, he can't regularly come into work over 2 hours late to accommodate mother's schedule. And that was reasonable for the trial court to take that into account in crafting the schedule. Mother argues that she is entitled to a full weekend of parenting time. I would just note that I am unaware of any cases in which this court has held that a full weekend of parenting time is required. And such a rule would greatly decrease the sort of way the unique circumstances of each family, particularly in this case where there were such unique circumstances with the conflict between the schedule and so on. In addition, you know, mother argues that the schedule requires her to negotiate with her abuser But the statutes that she relies upon in her brief are situations in which the parties are actually forced into a mediation and required to actually negotiate. Here, she's not required to negotiate at all. She can continue to follow the schedule that the court found in the best interests of child. And she's just not required to have that negotiation unless she wants to. In addition, there was an issue about vacation time. I believe that issue was based on a misinterpretation of the trial court's order. The vacation time takes priority over regular parenting time. And if you interpret, and the vacation cannot occur on weekend time, but if you interpret Fridays as weekdays, there's no inconsistency in the court's order. So that the court can interpret it that way and avoid the inconsistency. In conclusion, then, we would just ask that because the presumption against joint custody was implicitly rebutted and the other issues were not an abuse of discretion, we would ask that this court affirm the trial court's order.
Thank you. We'll turn back then to appellate counsel. You'll have the last word.
Yes, with regard to the standard of review on interpreting whether the court was required to make findings on the presumption, the Beaver case is the only one that we saw where, and it's an unpublished, where it allowed implicit. I'm asking the court to consider like the seriousness of domestic abuse. We're talking about a gun incident here and the finding of continued harassment. This is not some one-time thing that happened in the past. The court specifically found many findings about father's continued harassment and inability to make decisions in the best interest of the child, and his continued, you know, finding loopholes in court orders and continued unwillingness to follow court orders and, you know, just reckless disregard of the child's safety. So if the court would allow the court to just make implicit findings after a domestic abuse finding, we would submit again that this case, there just isn't the evidence to overcome all the very negative findings that go to the heart of why joint physical and joint legal custody doesn't work. The findings that are negative against dad go to the very things like ability to cooperate, the way he wants to win, the way that he is rigid in his thinking. It just seems.
Counsel, I wanted to ask, apropos of sort of the conversation we had with opposing counsel, is the finding relative to rebutting the presumption, is that, you know, you talk about it in two ways, and that's why I was trying to figure out how it works, whether the evidence would support it, which requires a record review, or whether one looks at the district court's other findings on the factors and say that given those findings on the factors, none of which favored father.
Well,
it's an abuse. One could not find as the secondary finding that the presumption is overcome. What does one look at, the record or just the district court's other findings and figuring that out on appeal?
Well, I think that the statute, there's a part of the statute that talks about how the court has to say how the factors relate to the determination of custody. And I would agree that, and I've seen in case law that in close cases, it's not exact scorekeeping. But I think that in this case, there is no supportable explanation of how each factor led to its conclusion that joint legal and joint physical custody was in the best interest of the child. This is
Do those factors go, and I'll reread this statute, do the factors go to that question, or they're the other issues that are within the presumption that were not explicitly addressed? Like the three, I don't remember what they are right off the top of my head, but in the that section dealing with domestic abuse, I mean, there are specific things that the court is supposed to address. I wonder if those overlap necessarily with the findings of the 12 factors.
Well, what I think the court did is, I think the court did the part of the statute where it was supposed to consider the nature and the context of the domestic abuse. But when you look at what it said about the nature and the context, it's hard to understand, and you read it with the other factors and how it ended up on each factor. It's very difficult to understand how it implicitly or explicitly overcame the presumption that's clearly in favor of sole legal and sole physical custody that was just recently addressed by the Supreme Court, that that's that once domestic abuse is found, this is the favored arrangement. And you describe the nature and the context, which I think she did, but then didn't do the last part. And again, the statute does have a part that says, technically, you're supposed to, on each factor, and it says it right here, the court must make detailed findings on each of the factors in paragraph A based on the evidence presented and explain how each factor led to its conclusion and to the determination of custody and parenting time. I think by kind of saying this factor favored mother, but then it gets confusing when you have all these factors that are all in favor of mother or neutral, not in favor of dad, and continued harassment on top of that. So I don't know if I'm answering your question, but I think that if the court really followed it, it would say each factor. I mean, that's what the statute literally says. I don't see that that happens in case law, and I see that cases are affirmed even when judges don't do that. I don't know if the court requires hyper-technical, where you read the factors and you're at the end and you're saying, how did this happen?
Your time has expired, if you could sum up.
Yeah, just on the parenting time, I just wanted to say the court did make a specific finding about how the face-to-face exchanges are bad. And the record does show that even when third parties tried to help out in that regard, they were still bad. Thank you.
Thank you to both attorneys for appearing in support of your client's position by WebEx. We appreciate you participating. The judges will recess, and we will not report back until the next scheduled hearing, which is at 11:10, although we will be in the lobby. Thank you to the attorneys. You can go ahead and log out.
Thank you.